there are overwhelming, turbulent times, but that also means there is major potential to fill the cracks with new ideas and to transform these destructive systems. There are specific root causes for problems and holistic solutions everywhere. There is room for prosperity, there is room for regeneration and a shift in values. Another reality is possible, and that's what we're exploring here today. Welcome to Sage Talking.
Well, hello in this beautiful podcast. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Tobias Lute, and I live in different parts of Europe, I would say, in these times, between Zurich in Switzerland, Ostana in the Italian Alps, Freiburg in Germany, and also in parts Oslo in Norway, which connects a bit my different types of works. The main center of daily life is in Zurich. I work at the Federal Institute of Technology, ETH, in Zurich, in the field of resilience of complex systems, systemic design, regenerative systems, hosting here teaching and learning system about designing resilient regenerative systems. Also, part of my work is at the Monviso Institute, which is in the Italian Alps, in the community of Ostana, in the Po Valley River, famous Po River, at the French border. And there we started a kind of mountain university campus, a so-called real-world laboratory in the field of sustainability and regeneration. And Oslo is part of my current portfolio because I have a part-time professorship there in the field of systemic design as well. So, and talking about passions, yes, one can hear it already. I'm interested in various parts of sustainability and beyond. Our contributions, both from a scientific, a designerly, and also from a practical and also embodied way. And so I'm a big fan of nature, outdoor sports, and all these locations. In addition to exciting work, also allow me to fulfill a bit of lifestyle goals of being able to do sports on the water, in the water, underwater, and on various types of mountain sports.
That sounds lovely, and also like it has a lot of variety in it, so it doesn't seem to get boring. Maybe you can share which influences did you have, maybe growing up or later when you were studying, that brought you to this point. What was the build-up and the inputs that you had to lead you on this way towards being an ally to nature and working in the fields of regeneration?
Yeah, the growing up, I think that's a really good point. It sets the basis, the foundation for everything else that comes after. And I had the luck to grow up in a very natural setting. It's a mid-mountain range in middle Germany, northeast of Cologne, called Sauerland, near Warstein. Maybe that's known as Krombach because of Warstein and Krombacher beer. I had lots of time in nature, and I had the luck that my parents built a house. Actually, they built three times a house, always in a quite natural setting. So I was introduced to nature, to building, to being outside, to help making firewood in the forest for our fireplace at home, to learn skiing because it was just still very wintery at that time, which changed rapidly in my childhood, learning to ice skate on frozen reservoirs. The Sauerland is also called Land of Thousand Lakes because of all the water, at that time all the rain. And in general, having had a family who took a lot of time to do stuff with us kids, me and my sister, outside, and also giving us space. And I was exploring the forests. I did my hunting license was 15, 16, a 1 year long training in Germany, and spent the next 4 or 5 years mostly in forests. So when others had dancing schools in cities, I was dancing in the full moon with the wild boars. and yeah, doing nature conservation, planting hedges, building ponds, and just having a really great time in that part. And I guess a very important element is the so-called German Urvertrauen, so the deep trust building in oneself and in life that I was lucky to gain through my parents and my family, which I'm really aware of today, what a gift that is, because you have more self-trust and can be more, yeah, creative, adventurous, entrepreneurial. And that is obviously a very important skill set if we engage in something such as regeneration.
Yes, 100%. I can totally relate to this phrase, this word of the deep trust in German. It's something my mother says often, so it seems to be a quite common theme in Germany, which I think is a very nice thing. And yeah, I really do think this aspect of being grounded in yourself, grounded in who you are, that sets one of the most important foundations for everything you do later, whether it's in terms of just being able to face hardships differently, to be more resilient in that aspect, and to also know a bit more of who you are and what you want to do, is definitely very important. Can you talk about some of the current projects or any goals you are working on, either alone or with other people? It can be either theory or practical work, something that has directly or indirectly to do with regeneration, just so you can give people a bit more of an idea of what you're the projects you tackle, what your work actually looks like, and the impact it has on certain places.
Yeah, so much of what I've been doing is very interconnected, and one supports or is dependent of or on the other. And so sometimes it may sound and look like, oh, this guy is doing so many things. How could he dare to? Today, I know that this is part of being a systems thinker and part of a certain culture of moving a complex system forward. And with complex system, I mean, basically our society, our societies, us as individuals, our communities, groups, our institutions, and the society we are living in. So all of this somehow needs to move forward, more regenerative and also resilient. Our status, fluid status, it's always moving. And some of these projects or engagements that I've been working on for, at least consciously half of my life, they're really interconnected. And so one main part, obviously, right now is my work at the ETH University, further developing this global learning ecosystem or learning system. We don't have to call it ecosystem. That's an inflationary use term, but a system that's interconnected and where many elements are interrelated. And we have this massive open online course series, which is for free, in order to bring this type of thinking and doing between science, design, and practice for free to a global audience. And meanwhile, there are about 6,000 participants from more than 100 nations. And we're growing this further, including an online community to have a chance for kind of live exchange, which of course is still virtual. But people are being nudged to engage in their own region, in their own location, and build their own learning group and cohort to also work on their questions regarding designing for regeneration. And part of this ETH program is an executive degree program that's for professionals. That's a very high-level paid program. We have professionals, mid-age careers between, let's say, end of 30 and 50, 55. Some of them have PhDs, and they're really engaged in, they are really professionals. And so we're co-learning, co-creating this work. And this ETH Zurich DRS program, this learning system, is related with another big project, and that's the Monviso Institute in the Italian Alps, which is an important component of my work right now. It's setting up this experimental outdoor kind of mountain university campus, as I mentioned before, a real world laboratory, or we can call it also a living lab or a bioregional weaving hub, for example. So different names for the same idea basically is to creating a learning and experimentation and research and entrepreneurship space where we can play in the unplannability of the real world, something that we cannot do at universities because that's a controlled environment for certain reasons. So, and these two main projects relate obviously also with some of my deep passions for mountaineering, ski mountaineering, climbing, telemark skiing, mountain biking, and also water sports, kayaking, wing foiling, windsurfing, and different types of bikepacking. So it's a whole set of beautiful activities, physical embodiments outside, and that is not only important for me and for connecting with friends, but it's also a learn didactic that's imminently involved in all our teaching and learning activities, both at ETH Zurich and at the Monviso Institute.
How do you find right now with many online courses and especially through the pandemic, a lot of shift towards online platforms, how do you find it is possible to create this balance between now a lot of virtual work and a lot of theory and the practical, which for me is equally, or in my opinion, equally or often even more important when it comes to certain aspects? How do you find, especially in education nowadays and also universities, how can that be balanced so that there's also a sufficient amount of, let's say, real world hands-on learning?
Yeah, that's a critical balance to find. I think many of us are struggling. Meanwhile, I think the move to more virtual learning, teaching engagement as a positive side effect of COVID is really helpful to be able to have a more flexible place-based lifestyle, to commute less if you don't want to commute, and all the freedom of spending more time where, with whom we want. And that's has been, anyway, a very much delayed development through our slow cultural transformation capabilities in general. So I think there's, in general, to me, this is very positive. And I'm very thankful for all the opportunities to participate without having to be everywhere and travel and commute. And making something possible, such as living a new mountain lifestyle and testing out a new mountain lifestyle, as long as you have a really good internet connection up there. So that's on the positive side. Also access to this global education. I mentioned the MOOC, and someone in wherever in the world can access this for free just with an internet connection. That's so cool. And I'm really thankful. On the other hand, to balance all the time, the extra time alone inside your home office, on the computer, staring at the screen, being fully immersed to electromagnetic waves from wireless routers. I measured how much from a tablet, how much radiation from a tablet. Or right now I'm having the laptop on my lap, how much radiation our bodies get from this, or from Bluetooth headsets around our neck. It's crazy what we're doing with our health, which is not visible, but we meanwhile have the research to make us aware that this is a potential danger. So this on the one hand, and then also losing the capability to make real world contacts, just talk to someone on the road. We're losing this skill set even more. And obviously very, very concrete, we're not physically moving anymore. We're just spending most of the time inside and on computers and devices. And then when it's dark, 5, 6 o'clock, we might go in a fitness studio. And that's just so sick, to be honest. And so what I'm trying to do is find this balance. being peu à peu more conscious with all the virtual talks and having less per day, trying to have walk talks, saying, well, we could also just have a phone call, like in good old times, a phone call even via whatever, WhatsApp, but doing as a walk talk, being outside, and obviously someone has to find a pathway that's calm enough and where you also have reception. That's one thing, exchanging voice messages, being more creative, saying, well, I can leave you 2-3 minutes what I want to say, and then you can listen when you want, and I can get back to it when I have time again. So that's something also very helpful. Using didactics in our courses, we try to encourage people to get out and wherever it's not needed to look at slides or graphics or tables, we encourage to just have the audio file, listen to it while going for a walk, for example, or doing, I don't know, any kind of physical activities. It could be even by doing yoga or fitness training, or even doing dishes, I don't know, whatever. And same time, with the beauty and this kind of smaller fixes, I think we need to be much more aware of where our cultures are leading us. And I think with more virtual technology, more AI, all these beautiful things that bring us a lot of positives, we need to, same time as a balancing component, invest more in physical engagement, in embodied cognition. And that's why we bring so much outdoor activities in our learning, teaching, and lifestyles. And I think this is something we need to foster more as a society.
Where in education is, in your opinion, the themes of sustainability and regeneration at?
Where it would be needed, clearly everywhere. We need to move beyond the disciplinary boundaries and also the notion that only a specialization is something we can trust. Today, we have experts who specialize or not specializing. And that's a new notion, because we are still trained and somehow have a culture where anybody who does multiple things cannot do anything for real. Today, in all these complexities and nested crisis and speed of change, it is a specific skill set to be a systems thinker and a systemic designer and be able to cross-connect while still having sufficient disciplinary depth to connect to very specific disciplinary experts. So it's needed everywhere. It's also coming for sure. I can say that for the last 20 years, being obviously and consciously engaged in sustainability education and practices. And I can see what happens. Let's say that it's like weather and climate. The weather pattern is what we see daily. So what we see in sustainability and education and institutions, it goes up and down, and there's a high peak and a low peak, and that has a huge fluctuation. But the general climate development and the general pathway of a society that includes more sustainability discourse, it's clearly has so much advanced. And today we have education programs that I could only dream of when I did a second master degree, a distance studies, that was quite early, 2005 or so. So 18 years ago, there was 2 or 3 things I could choose from. And today we have a global selection of amazing programs. So that has advanced. It's beautiful to see. And the opportunities we have today, including jobs in the field of sustainability, it's full. I mean, I get newsletters with job opportunities around sustainability. That's beautiful to see. And yet it makes it much more difficult for selectors, especially young people, to navigate. So there's much more choice and much more opportunities, but it's much harder to navigate and prioritize. And here we need to support and provide the kind of navigation help, kind of compass help, to be able to navigate in this complexity.
I want to ask you about some of your biggest learnings that you have maybe had in your years of kind of exploring, discovering also what works, what doesn't work, and being part of many projects in different places. I want to talk about the accidental soil degeneration at Monviso Institute. For example, maybe you could describe what happened there and then also share a bit about some of the biggest learnings you have had in terms of hands-on regeneration.
Yeah, I think that's a nice case. At the Mount Vincent, we have this campus on 1,500 meters above sea level, so quite an elevation. It's a rough climate. There's strong winters. There is strong winds right now. We have a lot of storms, fern winds. They're increasing in intensity through climate change, and we are trying to replenish and at the end regenerate this mountain campus consisting of 6 old stone buildings and like 2 hectare land about. And part of this is at the very beginning to just make it inhabitable. So we had to build a very simple way to park a car. And since it's sloped, it's on a mountain slope, we needed to move some earth from one place to the other one, building a kind of retaining wall, which usually is done by concrete, but obviously our philosophy and our design principles try to prevent and avoid something like concrete. So we used chestnut tree trunks from the region, which is a very durable, water-resistant type of wood. And we need some soil. So the helpers, the workers, at the very beginning when we came to this place, new to this place, we were very happy to get support, obviously, from local people, which we need. And so this company, this guy helped us. He came with his big excavator. And to be honest, for me, everything was new. And you've got to trust local people. So I just let him do. And we focused on this new part of the land to be able to finally have access to the land, just to drive in, park, and have something flat in this. It's like a terrace. And and he took it. He took soil from above the road, down the road to build this entry terrace. And he took about maybe half a meter total soil off the slope, the kind of grazing land above the road, until he came to the so-called sea horizon in the soil, so the rock, basically the barren rock, took off the fertile topsoil, including humus, and the different top horizons where soil organisms and organic matter thrive and live and provide the space, the nutrients, the moisture, the microorganisms for plants to thrive and to grow something. So he took this soil off, and I didn't pay attention. I also wasn't so much aware at that moment. So it was both being overwhelmed with so much new, being in a new country with a different culture and a language. I didn't really speak that well at that point. And same time having a certain focus on one thing, that new entry terrace, and neglecting the other one. Also because we didn't have a plan yet what to do with that land above the road where he took off the soil. So everything was fine until we started to think, oh, we could grow hemp here to demonstrate the potential of hemp, industrial hemp, as a circular plant for future mountain economies that not only depend on tourism and grazing of cows, and to build hemp composite skis, building materials, et cetera, et cetera. So even hemp, which is so durable and so doesn't need pesticides or specific soil conditions, didn't really grow there. It was just dried out. There was no humus, no nutrients, and no biodiversity in terms of microorganisms that are so important to provide that space for plants to grow. So we saw it every year. We tried to fix it and then became more aware that we actively need to rebuild this soil. And then we started to learn what could we do in terms of obviously natural regeneration takes a long time, especially high up in the mountains. So we bring organic matter in there, both leaves in autumn, fallen leaves, both manure, goat manure from the agriturismo, so the kind of mini farm up in that community, also compost, also charcoal from the fire. We have fireplace and then open a wooden pizza oven. And so from the fire, we take the charcoal, and the charcoal can be beautifully infused with nutrients, for example, from nettle fibers. So the nettle, the stinging nettle that we don't like when we touch them, but when we cut them and put them in water for a couple of days, then the nitrogen gets out. And if we put this kind of solvent together with charcoal, then all the microstructure in the charcoal fill in with these microorganisms, because they have a fertile environment to grow and to live and to thrive. And so on, this kind of charcoal, nitrogen, nettle fiber, growing microorganism mixture is then applied on the fields and slowly raked a bit under, so it doesn't meet the soil, the sun, the hot sun directly. So the temperature in that material isn't getting too high to not harm the growing microorganisms. And so this is a process over years, especially in the elevation. Yet it's so illustrative for something that we didn't know, we didn't focus on, we were overwhelmed. And it wasn't, at that moment, we were not aware to be systemic enough. So I learned from this many, many things. One thing is, it's normal that we do mistakes. So that's fine. We learn by doing mistakes. And this is a place to experiment and to also learn by doing mistakes. Because it is very complex, we'll always make mistakes. It is about taking the time to do a proper research analysis, meaning both talking to locals and also doing independent from local people, doing also scientific research about this process and asking people in other places and bringing different types of information together, taking the time for it, then applying it to the place and obviously, sketching a bit out what potential user scenarios might be for that particular place, to just become aware that maybe if we take something away somewhere, there is a loss of something. What would that potentially mean for the future in 5 and 10 years? So a more systemic approach, being more aware of what we do and why, allowing the time for it, having different types of resources and knowledge areas and directions to come together, not trusting just one person. I would never do that after many experiences in life. And same time, also being humble and saying, yes, it's also okay to do mistakes. We shouldn't freeze and don't dare to try anything out anymore. It's okay to do some mistakes too.
Thank you for sharing that very honest case. I think that was a very interesting one. And obviously, as you said, people should not be deterred from trying things and participating in regeneration, even if they don't 100% have a mapped out plan, which we rarely do in life, where they say we know 100% this is all going to work. So as you said, making mistakes and giving ourselves the freedom for exploration and trial and error is definitely extremely important. So I would like to know from you, what would your, let's say, ideal regenerative town or community look like? Maybe you could paint a picture for us.
Yeah, I think there are, first of all, many types of such microcosms out there possibly existing. And I think the first element we should be aware of is that it really depends on the place. It's so place specific that I could not paint a general picture, because climate, geography, culture, people, context, everything is so different And if I just think about the places I usually am between Scandinavia, Central Alps, Northern Alps, Southern Alps, just these places are so different that each place, in terms of regenerative living, would also be different. But there are some commonalities, and I think the first part in a culture to grow in would be to listen to the place and ask questions. So, as opposed to coming with a plan that we try to scale up and use it in general or anywhere, it's really important to arrive at a place, learn about the place, listen to the place, take the time to see what is there, what does nature look like, how does nature, including climate or specific weather, including the land resource, the topography, water, micro seasons, so not just the four seasons, but they're often 10 or 20 or more micro seasons. So learning a bit about these elements. And then obviously learning from the culture and the people one wants to live with. The generalizable part to me are based on listening to the place and asking questions, is obviously try to think and live and design in circular ways. And with circular ways, I just mean systems thinking. So cause and effect, whatever we do has an effect somewhere. And everything is connected. So thinking about relations, not only social relations, but also relations with the non-human, relations with plants, trees, animals, fungi. So everything that's out there, that's not a classic relation that we might think of, but we have relations with trees, for example. And I feel that all my life as a studied forest scientist and someone who spent his youth time most in the forest, trees to me they are creatures I'm connected with. I feel that I can speak with trees. So this deep nature connection, I think that's a start for any place to live more regeneratively. And that then reflects how one wants to live there in terms of buildings, building materials. Yes, obviously there should be from the place, or at least from the landscape, or at least from the region, they should adhere to at least to a certain amount of local building traditions that not necessarily are always good for the future. We need to distinguish. We are not living in a museum. We need to advance many things from the past into the future as well. So it's not about preserving something that has been there, but connecting with it and slowly and carefully translating it into the times that we are in and that we're getting in. And then in terms of circular, it's very important to think beyond the current circular economy. I like to think in five types of circular flows. So the circular economy is only a material economy. One's output or one's waste is the input of the next production process. So that's correct. It could be material and matter of different kinds. Yet there's also specifically water circularity, there's energy circularity expressed in carbon dioxide emission equivalents, there's financial circularity, and there's social circularity. And that's, I think, the most underrepresented one. So whatever we do as humans together with each other or also with the non-human has cause and effect as well. So I would really encourage you to think about these five types of circular flows when thinking, taking them as a question-based design principle to decide what kind of building materials, what kind of energy sources, what kind of local economic processes, what kind of activities do fit to that place. And then we automatically arrive to something that is towards regeneration.
Thank you so much for those thoughts and that input, and for lending your voice to the podcast.
Thank you, Stella, and a big encouragement for especially the young generation. There's a huge potential, but also beauty in acting more and engaging. All that's really difficult. And I can say from a bit of an older generation, we and those who are even older than me should not leave all the responsibility to the very young generation. That's an intergenerational engagement that we need. And so full motivation, encouragement for the beautiful design potential that there is for you guys.
Also, I want to acknowledge and honor Indigenous and First Nations peoples as custodians of most of planet Earth's biodiversity and bearers of ancient knowledge. I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize all Indigenous and First Nations peoples' strength, resilience, and deep connection to nature. Thank you.